Did you know that more Christians are persecuted for their faith in Nigeria than in every other country of the world combined? 90% of all Christians killed for their faith are Nigerians because the Islamic jihadists are destroying Christian villages, homes, and churches. But there is someone doing something. A team of American and Nigerian Christians called Equipping the Persecuted head toward the chaos while smoke is still rising. They pull lives out of the wreckage and help them rebuild. They provide emergency medical care, support for widows and orphans, security training, and meet other needs so Christians can rebuild their lives. This year, they are building a hospital and a women's rehab clinic to help victims, two new schools to educate over 800 displaced children, and they continue to equip villages with the security training and infrastructure they need to protect themselves in the future. Consider being part of the effort to support brothers and sisters on the other side of the world. Go to equippingthepersecuted.org. All right, welcome to the podcast. You can go to equippingthepersecuted.org if you want to support Nigerian brothers and sisters in Christ under persecution from Islamic terrorists. And another place you can go is christmascow.org, christmascow.org. Equipping the Persecuted is purchasing cows to give to villages. And one cow given to a village can go a long way. And so they're doing it in honor of Christmas. And it's $600 for one cow, $300 for half a cow, $150 for a quarter of a cow. And their intention is to give 50 cows. So I would assume that means 50 villages, but you can go to christmascow.org if you want to be part of that. With that, we're going to get into some topics today, and I hope everyone is has comfort and joy and is listening to Christmas carols. I've decided now that the day after Thanksgiving, it is permissible. I used to say it's December. I think because I have a kid now, I actually was pushing it a few days early. I was Sunday, I was starting to play him. So anyway, today is permissible, though. You can go and listen to Christmas carols now. And I had a good Thanksgiving. I had family over. It was actually a little small. Some people weren't able to come. We had snow in our area, not directly where I am, but north of me and west of me. And we get rain. The last two times we've had a dusting or snow, the other places have gotten it, and we've gotten rain for some weird reason. I don't know if it's because we're in a microclimate or what, but we needed the rain, so I'm glad we had it. I smoked 6 racks of ribs. I actually sent my wife to the store, and I said, get me some meat. I was thinking brisket would be good. It's expensive, but, you know, it's Thanksgiving. It's the one time of year, either that or Christmas, when you can justify it somehow. So I told her, check out the brisket prices and stuff, and she calls me and says, so I already left the store, and I have 6 racks of ribs, so I did it in two parts. I actually smoked 4 of the racks, and then I did the two more along with a turkey. I've never smoked a turkey. I was very impressed with how it came out. I was very surprised, and I just did what I did for the ribs. Actually, I used pecan, and I don't know what I say pecan, whatever you want to call that nut, that bark from the tree that produces that nut. That's what I used for the turkey because I just read online somewhere that was a good wood to use, and I had some. And I'll be honest, I didn't really like taste. Maybe it's subtle, but I didn't sense like overwhelming pecan taste. But there was still flavorful, and I sprayed a lot of apple cider on it. I didn't read that anywhere. That's just something I started doing to kind of caramelize some sweetness on my ribs, and it seemed to work well for the turkey. So overall, a success on the food, and of course we went around, talked about what we were thankful for, and all the rest. But I was up most of the night before smoking stuff. So I didn't get a lot of sleep, but I just conked out. I was hoping to go hunting this morning. Didn't happen. So this afternoon, we'll see if there's any deer out there, which this is my first serious time out, which is not good. Usually I'm out a few times and usually I have a deer by now, but life is busy and that's just how it goes. So anyway, I hope you all had a good Thanksgiving. Some people were asking, because I was posting on X about it at least, and wondering how it came out. Oh, and I did make the last video. I showed you some of the seasonings. I'll say this about those seasonings I showed you. The all-purpose seasoning from, what was it called, Barbecue Church or something like that. They're the ones in the store with the the cow, who's got a choir robe on, and Meat Church, I think, is the name of the brand. So their all-purpose was actually pretty good on the turkey. And I think if I had to do it over again, I would have went with that on the ribs. I used their, I think it's a mesquite kind of spicy flavor for four of the racks. And in my opinion, now some people really liked it. In my opinion, it's a bit strong on the pepper. Now, again, I like sweet. And their sweet seasoning, which I used on two racks, was really good. And I smoked four of the racks, the two sweet ones and two of the spicy ones on some hickory. And to me, that was very flavorful. And I didn't wrap them. I just sprayed the apple cider. The other ones I wrapped, the two other racks. And it is a very different experience, wrapping versus unwrapping. And it's hard to tell, you know, when you wrap, just for those who aren't initiated into barbecue, for the last 2 or 3 hours, it kind of cooks it in its own juices, and you have a very tender, soft exterior to your rib. So with the butter and the sugar, you could even add more seasoning. I don't do that, but it all melds together, and you pick it up and it just melts in your mouth. That's the kind of rib people say they like, because it melts in your mouth. If you don't wrap it though, and the longer it goes, the harder that shell gets. So it becomes like it changes the texture somewhat, right? So you're biting through first this caramelized, if you spray like I do, the apple cider, this caramelized layer into the skin, which is a little bit tougher. It's a little bit more of a barrier. And then the smoke ring hits you. And I think I like that a little more, but not everyone does. My wife likes it wrapped. So there's my barbecue lesson. And yeah, someone asked if we'll do a podcast where I'll be out in the smoker showing you stuff. And I don't feel like I'm at the level. I mean, there's shows where, you know, people are competitive with this kind of thing. I think I'm learning still, but if that's what the people want, that's what I'll do. Leave a comment. Let me know if that's what you want. If the people have spoken, we'll go out to the smoker and I'll show you what I do, and it'll be fun. So, all right, 7 minutes in, and all I've talked about is barbecue. And of course, we've also talked about equipping the persecuted a little bit in there. So I need to get moving here. We have a lot to cover. And I don't know how much I'm going to, so here's my thought process before I even commence on this. There is this Wheaton College, for lack of a, what would you call it? A summit? It ends in a panel, but it's a presentation, two presentations followed by a panel. It's an event. Okay. And this event is called the Polarization Thinking, What's Next? That's the event. That's what it's called. And it was on the 18th. So it was right after the election. They held this 9 days ago. And I'll back up a little. Wheaton College has some issues. I've talked a little bit, a very little bit. And it's the kind of issues you would expect, because a lot of Christian institutions of higher learning have gone pretty, to varying extents, but pretty hard woke, more than you'd expect, you know, hard on the social justice stuff, pushing left. We'll put it that way. And because I think so much of my focus has been with the SBC and SBC schools, to a lesser extent, the PCA, and then just in general organizations that have a lot of influence like CRU. I'm not saying Wheaton gets a pass, but I haven't focused as heavily on Wheaton. I've talked about them. Behind the scenes, I've known of some, in my opinion, pretty crazy stuff that has gone on there. Like, really concerning stuff. And I haven't talked about it. And I want to talk about it. I want to expose some of this stuff. And I want to start with this. I just felt like this was the place to start. It's recent. Does all of Wheaton University, I mean, this is going to be the comeback you always hear, right? Like, does Wheaton University endorse everything these speakers you're about to hear they said? Does Wheaton University have professors that might have different views? I'm sure they do, right? The thing you got to realize about the event I'm about to show you, though, is it's presented as a neutral thing. Like, it's not partisan. It's about polarization as a problem. But both speakers and the panel that follows and everything about it are completely coming from a leftist vantage point. And there's really no exception. There is no concern about polarization coming from the left. It's all the fault of the right. It's all the fault of quote unquote Christian nationalists. It's all the fault of the MAGA crowd. and they're believing conspiracies and they're not trusting the official sources. And it's everything you would hear on MSNBC with a Christian veneer. And it's very frustrating, to be honest. And because the people who are propagating this, and you'll see as I play it, they don't seem to understand that they're not self-aware. We'll put it that way. They're not self-aware. They think that they're unbiased, that they're objective, that they transcend this political divide. And they're here to tell you what God would expect, how Christians should navigate it. They're not unbiased. They're not. They have a team. They've chosen. And I have a piece coming out in the Federalist soon makes this point. Now, I don't talk about Wheaton, but I make this point more with the Christians who try to present themselves as transcending the political polarization are sometimes the most polarized. And they're pulling for one side, and it's the left. And how did our institutions get this way when 81% of evangelicals are voting for Donald Trump? It's a question worth asking and exploring. And I think I've come up with some answers to it, but it's still something I keep asking myself because it is an odd phenomenon. You have to admit that is an odd phenomenon. So we're going to talk about that a little bit. And I'm going to give you my answer, my response to this panel, this presentation that is going out to, in some part, to people who are training for pastoral ministry or training to be Christian leaders. So I will take, by the way, any questions today. This is kind of a loose, not a free-for-all, but I got my ball cap on. I'm not being that serious today. I didn't put the collared shirt on either. I got a t-shirt. I'm just hanging out with you the day after Thanksgiving. Some of you are probably streaming this as you're trying to find deals. That's what my wife is doing that right now. She's out there trying to find, well, I don't know how much of it is trying to find the deals and how much of it is having coffee with her friends. It's kind of like a tradition now. She goes out, she goes to the store, she has coffee. Sometimes she doesn't come back with anything. Other times she does, but maybe you're out there doing that. All right, we already have a question. Wheaton has been evangelical left for a long time. Are Trump voters still out on the premises? As far as I know, there are Trump voters, especially students, who are on the premises. So, oh, Jake, man, my smoker broke last week and I was forced to go back to using the oven. I don't want to see comments like that. Those are the comments that break my heart, and you don't want to break my heart. Drop that smoke video. All right. Well, we got some requests for the smoke video. You know what I'd love is if Meat Church sponsored the podcast. That would give me more incentive to really show you how I'm using their product. So maybe I'll put a post out there. I'll do it right now. How about I do it right now? You can all go since you're live streaming. Some of you, at least some of you, will listen to this on the re-record. We'll find Meat Church on X. And there it is. I found it already. It's just at Meat Church. That's the most simple handle. And I'm going to put a tweet out there. Meat Church, I would like to sponsor your products or your seasonings or your, we'll say, rubs. Let's talk. PM me. All right. Now, if you want me to do more barbecue content, you can go to my X account right now. It's the last tweet. I just put it out there and reshare that. And if it gets some traction, maybe we can get something going. All right. Have you talked about the Antioch Declaration? I'm confused about the racial animus that people like James White talk about. Yeah, I did. I did a podcast. It's long, about 2 hours, 20 minutes, one of my longest podcasts. And I am very frustrated in it. I don't have any notes. I don't write anything down or put a show to get like a slideshow. I just kind of talk from where I'm at, and I read through it and I express a lot of frustration with it. So if you want to go watch that, that will hopefully help you understand where I'm coming from on it. I have told people that I don't plan to talk more about this. You know, I may, but I don't plan to. After yesterday, and I think this, you can't really separate these things. I know there is somewhat of a separation, but the reaction is tied together. The reaction is to this, the aversion to signing it especially, is partially because there's an outstanding issue, has been, between Pastor Joel Webbin and Tobias Riemann Schneider, and then the guys who shared the video that Pastor Riemann Schneider put out that was attacking Joel. And and of course, you know, from the other side, I suppose, you know, Joel I guess some are framing it this way, that he initiated an attack on Pastor Riemenschneider. However you want to frame that, Pastor Riemenschneider actually put out a video yesterday. I was very glad that I put out mine hours beforehand, not knowing he was going to put out, after a month, a clarification or a second video. And all I have to say to that at this point is it makes me very sad to see where the attitudes are at and where the discourse is. This should be something. I agree with Aaron McIntyre, who put out a podcast about all this whole thing. And this really should have been all of it, I think, could have been handled much better, in my humble opinion. And I'm just, yeah, I see that when there's division like this and it's Christians, I can't help but wonder whether this is the devil also at work. I mean, that's what he wants. I mean, what did Christ want? He wanted unity. And this seems like some of the most unnecessary disunity that I've seen in a while. And so I don't really want to talk about it much anymore. I feel like I've said my piece. I don't have anything that I want to retract, that someone could show me something, but I have no regrets in how I've interacted with it. And I think had I put the video I put out yesterday, today or tomorrow about the situation, I probably would have been much harder on Pastor Tobias, to be quite honest with you. And I don't want to be harder on him. I don't want to talk about it. And there's a lot of people in the audience who are frankly sick of this. And I realize some of you that you've heard this for the first time, and it's very complicated. I was telling my dad last night, I was like, to understand this entire issue, it's like you have to listen to all these podcasts, and they're 2 hours, and they build off each other. And it's become one of those things where it's gotten to the point, things are becoming complicated enough that it's just like there's sides and there's bad blood. And some people probably don't even remember exactly what all the reasons are for why that's there. I mean, that's the typical clannish warfare of like the Hatfields and McCoys, right? Why did we start fighting? I don't know. Some people don't even remember, but I do remember enough to know the working issues. It just takes a long time to get through it and to do a fair job talking about it. So go watch what I've already put out there. That's my last thing I want to say about it. I don't really want to say anymore, and just pray for peace, and let's enjoy the holiday season and Christmas as much as we can. All right. Thoughts about euthanasia. Okay. David Carlson for $10, being legalized in the United Kingdom. Is it the forthcoming culture war? How do you Christians respond to this? Thank you for your Antioch coverage. Very helpful. Wow. Yeah. Oof. Yeah, of course it is. Of course, it's a very serious problem. And it's legal in some of the United States as well. So they call it death with dignity. There's now, some of you have probably seen online in Europe, there's these pods that you can, in some countries, I don't know if it's in the United States yet, but you can enter these pods and it's a suicide pod. It'll kill you, but in a way that's supposedly peaceful. It doesn't cause you pain. And you can exit this planet. I think it's bad for a number of reasons. Obviously, this is self-murder, it's suicide, breaking God's law on a fundamental level. Secondly, it also, I think, it comes from a very bad place. And when you have those kinds of laws that allow that, you're also coming from, you're encouraging, and what you're doing is you're saying that, morally speaking, this is not a problem. Now, some people have mocked laws that are against suicide or because like, what are you going to do? You're going to punish the guy? I think the issue more comes down to this. You have doctors and companies making money off of it. So it's the monetization of this. So that's the working issue. It's not, you know, the mockery about like, oh, we're going to make laws against like that. That misses the point. Like, this is, are we as a society going to encourage this kind of thing? And if you feel depressed one day, like where I live, there's a bridge not far away. There's all these signs, life is worth living, call the hotline, right? Are we going to, as a society, say, you know what, we're not going to do that anymore? Or at least we're going to send mixed signals. Well, maybe we'll still have that, but we're also going to start giving the impression that actually this is a perfectly permissible, moral, and fine thing to do. And the cost of this, I think, I mean, it's hard to quantify because I don't know of any studies. Maybe there are, but in all the situations I know where there's been a suicide, it has left absolute devastation for those who are still alive. absolute devastation. Devastation that lasts years, that lasts lifetimes. When it's a father, a brother, a cousin, a nephew, I mean, it's, you know, if you feel like you have no connection to anyone, maybe the impact is a little less minimal on society. But even then, I mean, someone has to take care of your body after you make that decision. Someone has to come to terms with the fact that there are people out there who think that the life that they've been given, this gift, is not worth living. And they should all go watch It's a Wonderful Life this Christmas. That's my opinion. So, yeah, it's bad. It shows further degradation, further an attack on the creator and his plan, and that he made a mistake in creating you or creating another person. And it's an attack on the created order, just like transgenderism is an attack on the gender binary, just like abortion is an attack on, frankly, motherhood and fatherhood and parenting and the baby that's in the womb and the whole structure. It's bigger than just the one person. This is a socially wide problem. John, I would love to have you and AD on to talk about how the internet has changed brother wars and if it's brought any useful and helpful tools to bear or merely complicated everything. That's a good question, man. I don't know. It's something I'd have to reflect on. I think it has probably produced conflicts that you would never have heard of. It wouldn't have been a conflict. I think overall it's bad, but again, you're listening to this podcast online. It's like any technology. You can use it for good. You can use it for evil. But I think that Kruptas has made a good point on technology, because, you know, he says that once you have the technology, it changes you in ways sometimes you're not always expecting. And sometimes the net, there's a net negative, even if it's like good content, even if you're listening to this podcast, there can be a net negative in that. How does he explain it? That shapes the way that you approach things and think about things and attention spans and that sort of thing. So, I mean, I'm of the opinion I wouldn't be doing the podcast if I thought that all technology was bad and all podcasts talking about issues are bad. I think there's potential for learning and probably being confronted with information and solutions even to problems that you never would have heard of if we didn't have technology. At the same time, though, I think overall there is a negative net effect. And it's hard. I'm in this position of being in a spot where I'm using technology. And at the same time, I want to go back in so many ways to pre-modern ways of understanding, thinking, and living. And some of those ways cannot be brought back. They're not compatible with a technological society. And I'm someone who's grappling with that and very aware of that, and probably in some areas blind to it. But I'm thinking through the creative ways that because it's not slowing down and it'll get probably even more ramped up with AI. I'm thinking of creative ways of trying to get away from some of the media impact we have and the short attention spans and the news cycles that last 2 seconds, while also engaging in a minimal way with the useful and helpful things that all of that can bring you. How do you cope with smoker cleanup? You know, I probably am doing it wrong. I don't like the sprays, so I just use a power washer. So I just kind of like clean it off with the brush, the racks, and then after the, I don't know, a month, 2 months usually, because it depends how often you're smoking, but I'll just like get a power washer and really clean it out. All right, we're going to get into physiognomy. I hope I'm saying that right. Am I saying that right? Physiognomy. Yeah, I think I'm saying that right. Physiognomy. So is physiognomy inherently sinful? People like James White or Chris say yes. Do they? I didn't know that. I knew there was a big debate. I didn't know that they were on that side. I'm going to get into that in just a moment. We're going to get into that before we get into the Wheaton stuff, even though we're 24 minutes in. A lot of questions coming in. I'm surprised how many people are online right now. Have you watched Wolf versus Gordon talk? I've watched clips. I haven't watched the whole thing because I've been listening to hours and hours of people trying to talk through the Antioch and the Tobias Joel thing. And I'm so sick of it. So sick of it. I kind of want to listen to the Wolf versus Gordon thing. All right. We're going to get there, Truddle. All right. Where do we want to start? Let's start here. Let's do the physiognomy. If I can say the word. I don't ever say that word in normal circumstances. It's something I only read online. So I've never actually had to pronounce it, I don't think. Physiognomy. There we go. I'm just going to go with that. let's talk about it a little bit. So there is a debate. I'm not going to talk about sides. I guess apparently James White and a guy named Chris are on one side of it. But here's what's happening, what I broadly see. So you have people, people on the right wing, people who are, I think there's a correlation here. Guys who are getting into the gym, who are powerlifting, who are really inspired to live in a more healthy way. They're rejecting the seed oils. And they seem to be the ones who are making this point more so that there is this element to your physical body that is also connected to your spirit, your moral direction, the way that you live and the way you come across in your character. Character and physical aptitude are somewhat similar, or not similar, but they're somewhat connected. I think actually there's some truth to this. I think you could dig it way too far. There are some very good looking people who go to the gym, right? Obviously who have deficient character in some ways. Now, I think going to the gym and that kind of thing, there's already an element of that you have discipline. Now, it doesn't mean you have discipline in all areas, but there is at least some discipline somewhere. And that is something you can build off of. And this is the kind of thing I think Jordan Peterson talks about and other like self-help guys. There's like obviously a benefit when the first thing you do is make your bed in the morning and you complete tasks and you get in the habit of doing things that are productive, because it will, like dominoes, it will land you into other productive things and you'll have a productive life, right? So a habit is formed by small actions over time that are consistent. And then that makes a pattern, it makes a lifestyle, and then you can be more healthy. And if you're more healthy, frankly, you're going to be more happy in general. That's just, those are general proverbial truths. I think physiognomy is like that. I think it is a general proverbial truth that has exceptions. There are people who are physically appealing who do not have good character. There are people who are not physically appealing who have stellar character. I think a lot of this, though, comes down to, it's not like someone who got burned up in a plane crash, right? That's not what they're talking about. They're talking about usually like character and life decisions, moral decisions that correlate to, or associated with, or have an impact on your physical appearance. Let me give you an example of that. So you are someone without self-control. Because you're someone without self-control, you don't eat healthy. You eat sugar. You eat the things that are taste good to you. And because of that, you'll do it in front of the television and you don't actually have an active lifestyle and you're constantly being entertained, right? And because of that, your mind turns to jello because you don't use it. And you outsource your thinking to other people and your attention span decreases. And because of that, you start to look a certain way, right? You get soft. It's not just a matter of having weight, but you're soft in that way. That weight isn't coming, you know, you're not out there doing work on the farm and you're burly. You know, that's different. No, you actually, you're soft. You become useless for physical activities. You can't actually go help someone move because you don't have the strength. And you can't hardly help yourself move because your body's in a particular state. And this is going to have an impact on you. If you're someone who is, and it also make you unhappy, to be quite honest with you. You're probably not going to be smiling as much as you think because you're involved in these distracting activities that are the devil's substitute for joy. They're not real joy. They're not going to give you that. And you just, when you turn off the television, you just feel like your life's a waste. Why did I engage in that? Why did I waste hours? Why did I waste days? Why did I waste years of my life on stupidity, on foolishness? And I got nowhere. I made no progress. And that's going to have an impact on the way you look. And this is something, let me just give you an example before I get into some scripture from my own life. I lived in North Carolina and I lived in Virginia for a little bit. And of course, I've traveled extensively too. And in different parts of the country, there are people from different ethnic backgrounds. So they look differently. You have people from in the Midwest that are German more so, and different kind of central European countries who've immigrated there, right? And you have Scots-Irish in the Appalachian part of the country and much of the South. You have Cavalier types. Now you have a lot of Yankees who have moved down. So you have Puritan types as well in the low country in the South. In the Northeast, there's a lot of like old kind of WASP stock. And so I get that there are different features that these different people are going to have just as a matter of the genetics they carry, right? But there is something else that I think is also very determinative. And I don't know to what extent it is. I just know I sense it more than I can probably articulate it, but I'm going to try. When I lived in Virginia, people were generally happier. Now, admittedly, it's a little more heavier Scots-Irish type people. And it's a mixture of people. For people in the area I lived, actually, there's a lot of people from the Midwest and even from the North and other places that have moved in. But even the people who came from New York that had a rough exterior, they kind of lightened up and they acclimated. They became a little more happy because everyone around you is happy. People are saying hello to you in the store. They're opening doors and smiling, and it makes you smile back. And they're saying, I like that hat. I like that dress. What do you think about this? You have connections with the humans around you. You're not so isolated. And the metric for living life is not so much your bank account and how successful you are, what position you have. It's more, who are your people? Where are you from? I mean, someone in Virginia asked me that, well, you know, who are your people? And I think it just, there's a happier lifestyle. Hey, it gets dirty on the farm, but we can slop around with the pigs and have fun. Like, you know, not everything has to be perfect and not everything is about impressing other people. So in the North, and especially New York has a reputation for this, it's the rat race. You are judged by your car that you drive and your account, your bank account, and these kinds of things. More so, there is more stress. There is more pressure. There is a higher cost of living that's hard to meet. So you have two breadwinners in the home, right? There's a whole host of things, and the culture around you is not helping. If they're not, they tend to pull you down more so. I'm telling you this as someone who's lived with the experience of it, not someone who's speculating on any of this. This is just true. Doesn't mean there's happy people, but there's less of them, at least publicly. The look on people's faces is different. And my wife and I have talked about this a little bit, that it almost seems sometimes like if you're used to smiling, the wrinkles on your face will land in a certain way. When your resting face may be different. If you smile a lot, then someone who frowns a lot, who's not used to smiling, who's constantly under pressure, who's right. And so what is that? Is that physiognomy? Whatever that word is. Well, your appearance does seem to indicate something deeper about you. And it does over the course of life, over years of things like not eating right and having a depressing lifestyle, it'll catch up to you. You'll look it. You'll look haggard. You'll look beaten. You'll look weathered. And you'll be the kind of person that's consistent with that look. Now, this is general. This isn't specific to every situation. This is just in general, you sense it, you feel it. When you go from the South to the North, I'm telling you, you start to feel it. And I remember one time I came up for a visit and I said, I smiled, said hello to someone, because that's just what you do in Virginia. And this person gave me a scowl and it kind of took the wind out of my sails. I realized, oh yeah, you don't do that here. People think that you want something from them if you do that. You just be careful with that, right? And that's not good, because we need to encourage that. We should be friendly. But it's so different. The lifestyle is so different. I remember when I was looking for colleges, I visited Liberty University. This was an undergrad. And then I was at Western Connecticut State University like the next day. And I remember on campus looking around, and I was a young man at the time, and I obviously wanted to find a wife. And I'm looking at the way the girls dressed and presented themselves and looked at Liberty. And I'm looking at the way the girls dressed and presented themselves and looked at WestCon. It was a huge, huge contrast. And it wasn't just the way they were dressed. That was, you know, at WestCon, it was like kind of like in the morning. It was like, who cares what I look like? Whereas at Liberty, they put a lot more effort into how they looked. But it was also just the looks on their faces. You could tell, you could just cut it with a knife, the depression, the sadness at WestCon. And so I think those things exist. We all know this. We all know this, that those things exist, that life on an individual level, lifestyle matters. On a social level, those kinds of things matter. And so let's get into the biblical stuff real quick, and then we'll move on to the Wheaton stuff. I think it would be foolish to think appearance does not factor into things like leadership, right? But it is certainly not the most important factor. So King Saul was tall and handsome, right? People praised Absalom for his looks. King Nebuchadnezzar chose to educate young Jewish men who were not only intelligent, but good looking. It's all in scripture. And it seems to be just in our experience, and scripture is no exception to this, that there is a natural human tendency to gravitate towards people who appear healthy, strong, and beautiful. Yet appearance, as we know, can be deceiving. So the Lord chose David, who was ruddy, who was had beautiful eyes and a handsome appearance. That's what scripture says, to precede King Saul. King Saul was good looking. So was David. People often will try to say, well, you know, looks is deceiving. God looks at the heart. Because look at King Saul. He was a head taller. And yet, well, look who God exchanged him for. Someone who scripture describes, and it describes it this for a reason, that he was ruddy, he was beautiful eyes and handsome appearance. That's who God chose. He also told the prophet Samuel not to consider appearance or height, because God sees not as man sees, for man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. So what do you do with all this? I think this is a difficult problem for institutions that are trying to produce leaders, because what we've seen in Christianity and in other institutions is the production of an image, and they're cheap to manufacture. So you have fashionable optics, and this is, I think, one of the hampering us from understanding this is we do live in a digital age, again, technology, where you can very cheaply kind of mimic, copy, produce someone who looks like they're all these things because it's a big show, but internally they're not. They're not really all of those things. And so you have stylists, and you have video editing, and you have airbrushing on magazines at the store and that kind of thing, right? And so we're suspicious when we see someone who's almost too perfect, because we think that there's a problem, that they're like, they must have some problem somewhere, right? And this wasn't always the case. So technology, I think, has made this a little more difficult in some ways. But I think these two things are not in conflict. God sees not as man sees. God looks at the heart. You can have a heart that is rotten and have good looks. At the same time, we see a pattern of, generally speaking, leaders, and even when God chooses leaders, tend to be good-looking people. And I think often the examples brought up to prove that this isn't a factor actually prove it's a factor. For example, I see people online saying that, what about Jesus? He wasn't a man of appearance that we would be attracted to him. It's really, I think that's talking about the crucifixion. I mean, he was beaten, he was marred, and that this is somehow an argument against the idea of physiognomy. And I don't think that actually proves what they're trying to prove. If anything, I think that's actually a separate issue, to be quite honest. It's someone who has been, from an external source, they've beaten him. I think some of the other things that have been said, like a good military leader, we'll put it this, like Napoleon, right? Like someone will pick an example out, like, hey, there's someone who wasn't tall. Well, that's just the point, though. He wasn't. That's the thing that's exceptional about him. It's when people try to, like, when people say adoption proves that there is no such thing as genetics or something, like lineage or whatever, like, because you can adopt, right? It's like, well, you're proving the opposite point of what you think you're proving, that the reason adoption is so exceptional and people praise it and it's seen as such a sacrifice and so forth is because you have a wonderful couple, hopefully, who they love these children and they're choosing to treat them as heirs. This is what God did with us, right? Choosing to treat us in a way that we're not deserving of, we're not naturally deserving of. So it actually reinforces the fact that there is this natural spot that a child would be in, and you're choosing to put someone in that spot who normally wouldn't be there. Isn't that a great thing? It is. And it's because there is this natural family unit. Without a natural family unit, it would be meaningless. It's the same thing here. Yeah, Napoleon was a good leader, and he was short, and you can be a short leader. That's absolutely true. Some of the best leaders can be short people. They can be people who are, you know, maybe were, they had an appearance that wasn't necessarily the most appealing, and they can be, have great character. But oftentimes what's impressive about someone like Napoleon is the fact that they were able to be good leaders when the natural proclivities of most people is they're going to choose someone who's tall. I didn't make that rule. That's just, I mean, you see that, like I said, even in scripture, that's why people chose tall Saul. This just seems to be a human nature kind of thing. Right. So I don't make a big deal about this stuff, but some people seem to, and I think there's some of you guys who are just like, think that physiognomy is everything. You need to like cool it. Like it's just admit there's patterns here and yeah. And you can recognize someone who looks a certain way and be like, look, man, the way like you look like you're not taking care of yourself. You know, why should we listen to you when you talk about an issue like self-control when it's like, it's obvious you don't really have it. I mean, it just seems that way. And there's all sorts of reasons for people gaining weight and that kind of thing. So I don't want to make a broad brush on this, but like there's obviously general impressions that we have. Yeah. And I'd say people who say that this isn't a factor at all, that like, you should never look at someone's appearance. Like, come on. If I came in here and I was just like, my beard was going all over the place. My hair was all disheveled. You know, I look like I just woke up. I had, I don't know, like a dirty shirt on, you know, what would you think? Right. Like, come on. Like that's important. And, yeah, more could be said, but that's my piece for now. So, all right. Questions real quick. And then we'll get into, some more. This is going to be a longer one today. We'll get into the Wheaton stuff. Thank you for talking positively about adoption. Yeah, no problem. I don't usually hear it. I hear it all the time. I think Christians tend to be positive about it, but I don't know where you're listening. Unprincipled living leaves a mark. Drugs, alcohol, junk food, STDs, lack of exercise, laziness, and overdoing the plastic Botox. Absolutely. Hollywood's filled with these people. They enter Hollywood and they look nice. And it doesn't take long, the lifestyle they live, and you're like, man, it's supposed to be the beautiful people. It's supposed to be the cream of the crop. And the lifestyle has an effect. There's no doubt about it. Okay. We're gonna keep going here. Oh, John, thank you for having Doug Robinson as a guest. I listened to both your interviews, and as a mom of a married lesbian, I agree with his observations wholeheartedly. Well, thank you for saying that, Tina. All right. I think that's it for now. We have the freedom to get into another topic. Let's talk about this Wheaton thing. All right. We're going to play just a 1 minute advertisement here, and then I'm going to immediately start playing the Wheaton stuff. So if you are a ranch dressing fan, you will appreciate the ranch dressing ad I'm about to play. And by the way, I have Lori's lunchbox packets on my desk, a whole bunch of them, and family members are getting them for Christmas. So I believe in this product very much. Looking far and wide for the best ever ranch dressing, I am excited to introduce you to Lori's Lunchbox, where they've developed the best buttermilk ranch dressing I've ever tasted. Their buttermilk ranch is made with whole foods and chiefly organic, ensuring the highest quality and freshness with every taste. Lori's Buttermilk Ranch delivers a rich and creamy flavor that will elevate any dish it accompanies. Whether you're dipping your favorite veggies or dipping your hot and crispy fries or drizzling it over a crisp salad, Lori's Buttermilk Ranch is sure to become a staple in your kitchen. When I first tasted her dressing, I knew I never wanted to go back to regular ranch. I myself use it on both salad and pizza, and it impresses any guest in the Harris home. I invite you to experience the difference that Lori's Lunchbox can make in your meals. Order now at www.lorislunchbox.com. That's lorislunchbox.com. And when you first order at least 5 packets, please indicate in the notes section that you heard about them on the Conversations That Matter podcast to receive a free packet of their buttermilk ranch. Happy ranching. All right, we're getting into it. Wheaton College. This is the Polarization and Peacemaking What's Next event from 9 days ago with Elizabeth Newman and Caleb Campbell. Let's start.
Down all of.
All right, let's, should we start? Man, how long is this? This is 1.5 hours. We're not getting through this today. I think we'll be lucky if we get through 10 minutes. Man, I don't even know. We'll skip around a little bit. Let's just start at the beginning and go from there.
Good evening and welcome. My name is Amy Black. I teach in the Department of Politics and International Relations, and it is my delight to welcome you all here this evening. On behalf of the Center for Applied Christian Ethics, the Department of Politics and International Relations, and the American Values Coalition, we are happy to introduce our event, Election 2024, Polarization and Peacemaking. What's next? And just in case you're curious, we planned this event months ago. We did not know who would win the election, but we knew that we would be polarized, and we knew, as always, that Christians would be well-placed to serve as agents of peace. And so tonight, I think you're in for a real...
It's funny she says this at the beginning, because you listen to the whole thing, and you get the impression Christians are some of the worst examples of peacemaking. So...
treat to hear from our guest tonight. Before we hear from our guest, though, I first would like to introduce Nap Nasworth, who is the Executive Director of the American Values Coalition. He earned his PhD in political science from the University of Florida, and he's worked in academia as well as in journalism. He served for 8.5 years at the Christian Post and now has been in his position for a while at ABC. So join me in welcoming Nap Nasworth.
Thank you. Let me see. I think I have a slide here. If I can. There we go. All right. So just to tell you a little bit about American Values Coalition, we started in 2021 out of a concern about the amount of misinformation and political extremism that was taking place, especially in conservative communities and in conservative churches and evangelical churches. But we wanted to approach this problem as people who are ourselves evangelicals and conservative. This is a conservative speaking to conservatives situation, as I often say, sort of a clean our own house situation. And so we use trusted voices to reach people who have been, who are being radicalized and who are being misinformed based upon oftentimes their media sources. And we have a particular concern about the broken relationships that have occurred because of the radicalization, the extremism, and the misinformation that's taking place. We've heard tons of stories over and over again about families being torn apart, churches being torn apart, friendships being torn apart because of what's been taking place.
Okay, so here's what he's talking about. This is the American Values Coalition. I just looked it up real quick, and you can see that their mission is growing a community of Americans empowered to lead with truth, reject extremism and misinformation, and defend democracy. And he just told you he's concerned with it coming from conservatives. And all the buzzwords are there, right? It just sounds like, I mean, he works for ABC, so that wouldn't surprise me, but he sounds like he's coming at this with an eye to blame Christian, more conservative types. But, you know, let's give him, I guess, as much of a benefit of the doubt as we possibly can. Keep listening here.
So I would love for you, if that sounds interesting to you, there's a QR code here. It'll take you directly to a site where you can sign up just to get more information. It's just to sign up for our email list. Also, we have some cards on.
Okay, I don't care about his advertisement here. Let's just skip ahead. The important thing is, if you have kids and you're thinking of sending them to Wheaton, what are they going to hear? What's the kind of thing that Wheaton presents to them? And, you know, I wouldn't expect because of what I've done, but if I was just a normal Christian family, I would expect Christians to veer more conservative because that's who they are, evangelicals. And at the very least, if they're going to do an event like this, for it to be balanced, right? If it's going to, I would expect them either to veer conservative or have both sides presented, right?
Desert Springs Bible Church in Phoenix.
Okay, he's introducing the speakers. We're going to get past that. All right, so here's the first speaker. This is Elizabeth Newman, and she is a former Homeland Security official. So they have her come in to talk about this.
Because we're going to talk about some dark stuff, but hopefully you'll stick through it to the end because I am not one that likes to wallow in the dark but looks for the light. But I want to start a little bit about my background and why I'm standing on this stage in front of you today. I came into the Homeland Security space because of 9/11. I was working in Washington, D.C. at that time, and I can still palpably remember the fear and the hypervigilance that was coursing through my body that morning. And for all of the chaos and the panic that was happening around us, we were moving painfully slow down Independence Avenue in my hatchback, and I had a bunch of friends that were crammed in there because nobody wanted to be on the metro. And I could see the smoke from the Pentagon off up ahead of me to my left. And at some point, there was a gap in the buildings on the National Mall. And in my rearview mirror, I could see the Capitol. It was still there. You see, at that time, there were lots of reports that there were still planes in the air. We didn't know about the bravery of Flight 93 yet. And we do now know that that plane was most likely destined for the Capitol.
This is a very heavy intro, I would say. This is, we're starting off, like, you want to talk about polarization. Let's bring up probably in the minds of most people, one of the biggest, most defining national moments that we've had since World War II. I mean, let's bring up 9/11.
So at the time, we were expecting much, much worse that morning. Like so many in my generation, 9/11 changed my career path, and I swore to do whatever I could, answer phones, get coffee, whatever, to make sure that terrorists never struck the homeland again. And for the next 20 years, it was my honor to be a small part of the counterterrorism community. But then it did happen. Terrorists did attack the Capitol. They killed 5 law enforcement officers. They injured nearly 150 others and caused $2.8 million in damage to the Capitol. But this time, they had invoked my faith to justify their actions. Instead of Allahu Akbar, God is greatest, which was the phrase Muhammad Atta instructed the 9/11 attackers to use, it was a weirdly dressed man known as the QAnon shaman shouting, "Thank you, Heavenly Father, for gracing us with this opportunity," and invoking the name of Jesus Christ to close the prayer in the United States Senate. That dark afternoon in January, I was watching people from my community complete their rage-fueled metamorphosis into violent extremists. And I mean my community quite literally. Of the 1,561 people that have been arrested so far, 121 came from my home state of Texas, and about 40 of them came from the North Texas counties I lived in or attended high school in. But it's broader than just geography. They were people who, like me, grew up listening to Rush Limbaugh, cheering on the advent of Fox News. They were Christians who, like me, were told that a real Christian could only vote Republican, of course. There were Christians who, like me, had been told America's rejection of God and the loosening morals would lead to a country in decline. God will remove his blessing from America, just like he did Old Testament Israel, and this will be catastrophic. This is what I was raised on. This is what I believed till about 10 years ago.
All right, realize what's going on here. She's making a few jumps, but she's tying a number of things together to try to make this argument. She's starting with 9/11, which everyone universally agrees was an attack. Then she compares it to the attack on the Capitol. That's how she frames it, at least, on January 6th. And so that's the first thing that I would examine and say, I would laugh that out of the room. To be honest, she should be laughed out of the room, frankly, because that's a ridiculous comparison. And the only way to try to make it work is she's got to try to upplay how much damage and how many lives were lost. So she says 5 law enforcement officers lost their lives. Okay, and I've heard, obviously, this is MSNBC type spinning going on. This is what the MSM was doing. I don't even know if the whole MSM was doing it. MSNBC and the radical left outlets were doing this, where they were saying that five people were killed. Yeah, there were some people who died afterward who they've categorized as their deaths were related to this, which, you know, it's really, at the very least, you'd have to say disputed. But there's only one person who died in that entire thing that day during the actual event, right? And that was not someone in law enforcement. That was Ashley Babbitt, who apparently, I guess her life doesn't count in this. I don't know. And if they were really attacking, I mean, there's so many, I've talked about January 6th. We're not going to go into that anymore, but it's laughable that she tries to make this comparison. And then to try to talk about this extremism, which is she's going to go on to talk about with skipping over all the left's actual attacks, actual property destruction, the largest insurance payout this country's ever had. It wasn't a hurricane. It was the 2020 protests. There is no acknowledgement of any of that. The left is by nature, they have at least a wing that is by nature violent. The people who went in on January 6th, if they were by nature violent, there would have been a whole lot more deaths. There would have actually been weapons there, right? Why weren't there? How come these people who went in there didn't have firearms? They weren't there to kill people. And the only one killed is one of their own. That's really curious. A lot different than 9/11, but she has to try to make this tie. And the second tie she makes, and she wants to tie what happened on January 6th to normal, everyday Christians who listen to Rush Limbaugh, who are going about their life thinking Republican Party is the only option for a Christian to vote for. Obviously, on issues like abortion, that's been quite the take for a long time in the religious right circles. She wants to blame them, wants to blame red state America, people that she's lives with in Texas. And so she's got this, she's like whistleblowing on her own group. And so that gives her somewhat of a legitimacy. Like, these are my people. I understand the thinking behind this because I guess a huge part of the country thinks this way. And that would make you scared, wouldn't it? If you really thought that Rush Limbaugh listeners who live in red states who are Christians, which is a fairly large group, could any moment do a 9/11, right? And you have someone on the inside saying this is how they are. Frankly, it's disgusting. The event should have been ended right then. This is an insult to the people who sacrificed so much and paid for their children and paid to build up Wheaton College. It's an insult. Like, are Christians the only ones who like to pay for people to come in and insult them? Because it seems that way sometimes to me. Like, not me, but these institutions that claim to be Christian that had some Christian roots, they seem to really enjoy it when someone comes in and tells them how terrible they are. Very interesting to me that this kind of thing is acceptable. Would it be acceptable anywhere else in any other institution? This stuff has to end, obviously, but it seems like it's just being ramped up, and the Trump win is not promoting any kind of self-reflection here.
This is my community. How do followers of a religion based on radical love, the kind of love that says if someone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other as well? The kind of love that says love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. A love so otherworldly that Christian teaching says it's actually impossible to live out without the indwelling of the Holy Spirit. How do people claiming a faith premised on radical love become so angry and violent? These were my outraged cries and burning questions after January 6th. How did Christians embrace extremism, the field that I had worked in for 20 years? I spent the next 3 years researching and writing a book to better understand how this happened. And more importantly, Kingdom of Rage talks about what we can do about it, how we find that path back to peace. So to answer these questions, there are a couple of things that are important to understand. First, fear of the other, hatred of the other by itself is not extremism, though it is a primary gateway drug, and science tells us it's unhealthy for you and me, so I would not suggest it. But
she's not suggesting fearing or hating the other And she's saying that she's asking why Christians are angry. I ask you, though, to apply the same standard to her as she's speaking. Is she making any kind of separation here between herself and the good Christians who don't have that hate and fear, and then the bad Christians who do? Are they the other now? And is it okay to demonize them or to be angry at them? If that's the gateway drug, then I would submit to you, she seems to be on her way to at least, I'd say she's just taking the gateway drug. She's on her way to more than just the gateway drug here. So apply the standards that these lefties have to themselves, and you'll see that it's very discrediting.
Extremism is something darker. It's the belief that your success or survival requires hostile action against the other. Hostile action. It's not the belief that I've got to go vote or pray, run for office myself. The answer, the only answer, is hostile action. Now, what is hostile action? Hostile action is on a spectrum. The lower end includes non-criminal behavior like bullying, harassment, threats, intimidation, discrimination. And the upper end includes criminal activities, vandalism, destruction of property, hate crimes, terrorism, and genocide. And people don't just jump to becoming a terrorist. They always start on the lower end of the spectrum, and then they advance up. Not everybody, smaller and smaller percentages advance up, usually asking themselves some sort of question. Am I doing enough for the cause? Or having a leader suggest you're not doing enough for the cause. And if the answer is, no, I'm not, they might progress to that next level of hostile action.
Elizabeth, are you doing enough for the cause? Are you doing enough for this cause against extremism and Christian nationalism and the horrible people that are calling themselves Christians out there? Are you doing enough, Elizabeth? Oh, I just lost my place. I got to go find it now. We might enter at a different point here, but you can pick up where this is going.
America's rejection of God.
Okay, I think we already heard that. Let's go forward a little bit.
And includes criminal activities, vandalism, destruction.
Okay, we just heard that. Let's go forward a little bit more.
Now, I'm going to oversimplify here. Radicalization is not linear. It is rather complex. But when you boil down all of the academic research into the causes behind various people that have joined terrorist groups or committed terrorist attacks, the most common unmet needs are belonging and significance. So when these basic human needs go unmet, we become vulnerable, more cognitively open to the narratives of extremism, and often this occurs activated by some sort of crisis or event, an experience of humiliation, a loss of control, uncertainty, a sense of unaddressed injustice. Now, have any of you experienced uncertainty in the last 4 years? How about loss of control? Maybe loss of a loved one. COVID was really hard. We like to forget it because it was so hard. It challenged our ability not only to have community, created that great uncertainty.
She's creating uncertainty. This is the funny thing to me. Like everything she says, I'm thinking, right, so like you guys are stoking the flames of this. And you're giving the impression that there's this huge group of Rush Limbaugh listening Christians in red states that would just go attack the Capitol and kill people and do a 9/11 because they're uncertain and they're trying to find a way to cope with the uncertainties and insecurities of their life. That's obviously crazy. There's no reason to think that's a real threat out there that's of any significance. But now you're creating uncertainty in the minds of people sitting in that room, and you're making them worried and concerned for things, frankly, they shouldn't be. And there's much, much bigger threats out there that are being completely ignored. I'm going to skip ahead a bit. I know many of you are like, my ears are bleeding. Let me skip ahead like 10 minutes in this talk and we'll see where she's at.
Black Americans at a top grocery store in May of 2022 wrote in his manifesto that he was not a Christian, but believed in needing to restore a Christian culture. I really think it's critical for us as Christians to be aware of this fact, that we actually have extremists who are intentionally walking a fine line. They are savvy about this.
All right. I know what she's talking about. That was in Buffalo. And so I'm going to tell you something about this that I don't think I've shared. I might know more about this in some parts of this than she does. So there was a few years ago, a guy, and this was one of those it's a rare case, but it actually did happen where it was a white guy, a white kid, who went into a grocery store and started shooting people who were black. And it was kind of like the Dylann Roof scenario, right? Where he did have an axe to grind, some kind of like a racially charged hatred that led to murder. It was evil. It was wrong. I happen to know, though, from a connection I have, a personal connection, someone who, someone close to the situation who knew about this kid beforehand. And let me just tell you something where there was a breakdown. This kid was, I think a few of his buddies were saying outrageous things. They were writing papers in high school, submitting papers for homework that had plans to murder, plans to do horrible things. They were violent, and this was known, and it went, this is what I was told, at least from someone who I trust, who's very close to the situation. This went unreported. It had to do with the dynamics today in schools, and New York schools, I think, are, from what I understand, particularly bad for this, where basically the teachers can't hardly do anything. They can't touch the kid. They can't discipline the kid, obviously. But if they ever critique the kid, then you have the parents jumping down their throat. And there's this environment where you just kind of let things happen and you don't take them seriously. So I happen to know this about that particular incident, the one she's talking about. And she admits here, the guy wasn't a Christian. The guy is not a Christian. He has a pattern that I know about that demonstrates he wasn't a Christian. And now, who's to blame for this? Christians. Now, she says she wanted to restore a Christian culture. I don't remember that in the manifesto. I'm going to look it up here real quick. What is she talking about? I mean, she already tried to make like the QAnon shaman was a Christian, which he's not either. So she's like, in order to make her argument work that Christians are just like ready to do this, she's brought up two examples that are not Christian. Okay. So I have the manifesto now pulled up, and let me see if the word Christian comes up. Are you a Christian? This is from the manifesto. No, I do not ask God for salvation by faith, nor do I confess my sins to him. I personally believe there is no afterlife. I do, however, believe in and practice many Christian values. So that must be what she's... That's it. That's it. Oh, my goodness. Right. Yeah, that's the Christian's fault. Man, it sounds like a real Bible-believing... I'm mocking, of course, but yeah, it sounds like a real Bible-believing Christian there, Elizabeth. Maybe if he had some Christianity, this wouldn't have happened. Maybe that's the solution and not the cause of the problem. Man, this is insane. These people, I don't know how we share platforms with people who think this about us.
They co-opt our symbols, our text, our Bible verses, and our Christian culture to cover their dark intentions. The ultimate goal of a white supremacist and an anti-government extremist is to destroy the current U.S. and set up a new vision of the country that aligns with their values. So for a white supremacist, they want a white nation state. If you're an anti-government extremist, you want to go back to what you perceive to be the founder's intent. But it does not look like a pluralistic society.
That's the key. That's the key to all of this. It does not look like a pluralistic society. Elizabeth Newman wants a pluralistic society. This is about presenting liberalism as the default, the normal, and anything that deviates from that as the weird, as the potentially harmful, we're going to like spin off into outer space if you have someone that wants a society that's not pluralistic. Now, the question for Elizabeth Newman is, so how far are you willing to go to preserve your pluralistic society? and, you know, quote unquote, democracy and these kinds of things. Does what if the majority of people vote against democracy? This is hypothetical, of course, and want a Christian nation state that's explicitly Christian. Are you going to contradict democracy at that point? Are you going to say that the will of the people doesn't count in that case? That this, what, where is the line? That's what I'd like to know. Like, what is the Christian position here? Because what's being presented to a Christian university is that the dangerous thing, the thing that's going to kill us all, right, is getting away from pluralism of some kind. And even if you're not a Christian and you want to get away from pluralism, somehow that signals you kind of like you're in league with the Christians. You're attached to them somehow.
Today. And for some of those, they want to go back to male, white, only landowner votes. So very different picture of what you might think conservative culture teaches about limited government.
So George Washington lived in a time when it was just assumed landowners got to vote. Is he, you know, is George Washington now, in the ideas that he had, are they now connected to or in league with someone who wants to go shoot up a grocery store or fly a plane into a building? I would submit to you, no. But for people like Elizabeth Newman, she makes these connections. And these are the connections that are holding the liberal order together, because people are so deathly afraid that if we step out of it a little bit, we're going to go into violence. I'm going to skip ahead a little bit. I would like to get through this, Elizabeth Newman, at least.
It's impossible to know, though, which ones at the top of the funnel are the ones that are going to make it down to the bottom. That's a huge problem. Further, we have multiple modern case studies of populism and political violence around the globe, and we know that public support for political violence actually encourages volatile people to move to violence. I believe we saw some of that this year with the assassination attempts on now the president-elect Trump. That's why we find ourselves in a precarious moment.
Thank you. Now, I've listened to this before, by the way, so I know what she's saying and stuff. That's the one time that, and she doesn't like it. Notice how she leaves it kind of out there. She doesn't blame a group. There's no actual group responsible for the assassination attempts on Trump. It's this abstract thing. It's political violence that's just in the world of the, I don't know, like the world of ideas. And everything else is rooted. Everything from the right is rooted in it's the Christians. It's like this group of people, but not that. It's like whenever a violent act happens with a gun and it doesn't fit the left's narrative, it's the gun's fault, right?
2%. 32% of Americans believe violence is usually or always justified to advance a political objective. That's 84 million people. 3% of Americans believe political violence is justified now.
I wonder how many of them are on the left. I really wonder what the breakdown of that is. I don't think she'll tell us, will she?
That's 8 million people. There are 800,000 sworn law enforcement officers in this country. We simply do not have enough security forces or protective capability to guard against 8 million, let alone 84 million potentially violent people. The only way to solve this problem is not through security.
This is insane. This is absolutely so. 8 million people answered a poll, supposedly, that I haven't seen, that said there's times at which violence is acceptable, right? And the left, you always hear this because literally Hitler is in office. And if literally Hitler's there, then what do you think is going to happen, right? So these 8 million people, they can't be stopped by 800 that or whatever she said, 80,000 law enforcement officers. Yeah, they're all gonna arise at once. They're all organized. They all have goals and objectives, and they all somehow can get on the same page and decide collectively that they're going to push for violence. This is ridiculous. This is fear mongering. This is like textbook fear mongering. Some people on a poll said that there's times in which violence is justified equals there's eight what did she say, 8 million people that are ready to rise up and kill all the police officers that you have in your country. Yeah, if I was taking this woman seriously, I would be probably becoming neurotic. I would be afraid to leave my house. That's what this, and that's apparently the basis for the extremism in the first place, is this fear. She's the one stoking it.
It's rather that we have to reduce the pool of people who have embraced extremism and are cognitively open to violence.
Sounds like you need a final solution there, Elizabeth Newman. You gotta reduce the amount of people who have embraced this. Now, of course, you'll hear her solutions for this. And that's okay, sure, fine. Let's reduce the amount of people who want to appeal to violence. But under her own logic, not my logic, her logic, how is that not some kind of a dog whistle to really deal with this matter?
Thankfully, mass violence remains a pretty rare event. And yet, the number of mass shootings in the U.S. doubled in a span of 7 years. Were you tracking that?
Yeah, how many of them were in 2020? I wonder a little bit, just a little bit. I don't know. But this, and I haven't read that stat, by the way. My understanding was they were going down a little bit. So could this be the Ferguson effect? I wonder if that has something to do with it.
Probably not.
And what communities? I wanted to know that too. That would be like a good solution, right? If we're going to solve this problem, what communities? Is it the Christians that you've talked about so much? Are they the ones that are going and shooting people so often now? Is it them? You haven't been able to give one example of Christians. Where is this happening? What geographic locations? Oh, it's inner cities where they backed off their police force. Wow, that's interesting.
Domestic terrorism incidents increased by 357% between 2013 and 2021. Threats to federal officials, so this is legislative, executive, and judicial officials, increased by 400% from 2017 to 2023.
What are we cataloging as a terrorist event? Is this 2020 we're talking about? And also, I would wonder, is there any correlation between more people are on the internet now, more people have access to social media now? What constitutes a threat? Is it someone saying something dumb online? Because yeah, that happens all the time. That doesn't mean there's a rise in people that have those sentiments necessarily. It could be that you know about them more now.
Grown numb. We've also bought into this lie that there's nothing to do. We've let the political tribes tell us there are just bad people out there, there's nothing we can do about it. And oh, we just need gun control. And those are our only two options. And so what do? When we feel powerless, we just kind of check out. Meanwhile, we have kids dying. We have families being threatened.
In the womb or outside the womb?
And it didn't used to be this way. And I want to challenge you that it doesn't have to be this way. I personally believe we can change this in the next generation. 10, 15 years is what we need. So there's good news. The first part of the good news is that people can change. We can prevent and disrupt radicalization, and we can help those that are radicalized to disengage from it. With an understanding of those underlying drivers I mentioned, we now know better how to help people that are vulnerable.
Now think about what she's saying. We're going to reprogram people. We're going to do the whole, I don't know if it's going to be Soviet style, but we're going to do some kind of like a re-education. But if the extremists are 8 million people, if the extremists are Christian Red State Rush Limbaugh listeners, you realize the scope and scale of such a re-education program, don't you? Like this is massive. This means to me, this is a narrative that would ultimately play into like the national, the general government must do something because this is such a big threat. That's how she's presenting it. Like this is big. This is like ominous. And the good news is we have the technology. We can reprogram these people.
There are absolutely governmental responsibilities here. Congress is woefully underfunding a public health approach to violence prevention. We are currently funding.
There it is, Congress.
3% of the annual recommended amount. And we are a decade behind Europe, the UK, and Canada. But perhaps the work that really needs to be done. It's not necessarily something government can do.
Europe, the UK, and Canada, really those are the places where you just don't see any extremism, right? They're the models. We're just behind them. If we were just more like Canada, Europe, and the UK.
It really is at the community and individual level. When you ask a former extremist why they left extremism, why they left that path of violence, they will often tell you because they had an unexpected encounter with empathy. When you
I was walking down the street the other day getting a slice of pizza and, you know, thinking about how extreme I am, you know, like missing Rush Limbaugh because I used to listen to him on the radio and thinking like, you know, he used to encourage me to go do terrorist stuff. And, you know, I just walking down the street and then all of a sudden empathy came and brushed up beside me. And I've never been the same. Just that encounter has changed me forever.
Ask the counselors that work with them, they will say, yes, that's true. And also, they experienced accountability. Maybe they lost a job because the business owner saw the white supremacist tattoo.
So part of the re-education means we start canceling people. We start firing people. That'll do it. Yeah, they have a tattoo that we consider white supremacist. Maybe, what would those be? I guess, Emma, what is the National Security what organization was it? The Department of Homeland Security. What was the list that they put out a few years ago? The three percenters, right? I think the Don't Tread on Me thing was part of that. And like, it was like all these like patriotic American Revolution type symbols were on the white supremacy hate list. I'm sure any Southern Confederate type stuff would be on that. So we just fire those people that you know, are some probably legitimate patriots, many of them. If we just fired them, we can avoid the catastrophe of another 9/11 because of 8 million angry people. Yeah, great.
Maybe their marriage disintegrated because they were so focused on this ideology and it was making them more hateful and difficult to love. So there's usually...
Yeah, I know some feminists like that, to be quite honest. Like, they were... does this happen on the left at all? Is it like... It's the people with the tattoos of the hate symbols. Those are the people that marriages are failing there.
Some type of accountability. But it's also matched with empathy.
Nothing says empathy like firing someone.
To put it in biblical terms, it's truth combined with love. I believe much of this needs to be led by us. I think Christians and those who consider themselves part of that conservative or center-right community have a responsibility here. We need to see the damage that has been done. We need to repent of our role in it. And I would challenge you not to brush that aside.
So she's telling Wheaton College, we, as in collectively, Christians and this institution are somehow responsible for the extremism. Everything she's talked about, there's a responsibility Christians have they need to repent of. It's a sin. They are in sin somehow. So I don't know how to make any sense of this other than to say, if it's people on the center right, so it's your normies, it's your moderate red state Rush Limbaugh listening Christians and the people at Wheaton College who are responsible somehow for this, then read between the lines, guys, who she's talking about. This is also in the context of an election that's just happened. Who is she talking about? What is she talking about? We need to fire people. We need to re-educate people. The government needs to fund this. Who did what? Who elected who? Think about it.
We'll get to why in a second. And we need to be ministers of reconciliation within the church and the broader community. Now, this really is a mission for anybody. You don't have to be a former Republican like me or a Christian to bring healing to our country.
A former Republican.
The epidemic of violence is actually driven by many other factors that have nothing to do with the Christian community. It's directly tied to our individualistic and isolated culture. It's stripped us of deep community, and our hyper-achievement culture sends these signals that you don't value unless you accomplish something that matters.
So it's not just the fact that you're a Christian, that you're guilty and need to repent. It's also you're an American. It's your culture. Because we already heard that Canada, Europe, England, so far ahead of us. It's this hyper-individualistic culture, which oftentimes when people on the left talk, they're talking about this is American individualism, man. So, it's just we got to be reprogrammed on such a fundamental level. The Christianity, the individualism, it's just, how do we not cascade into outer space?
Or at least you can make yourself appear like you matter on Instagram. For a variety of complex reasons, despite the unprecedented amount of individual freedom we now have, it is actually harder to meet our needs of belonging and significance.
She's right about that. She is right about that. And the question, I guess, would be, so how do you restore those communal bonds that have been broken? Is it by firing people and re-educating them? What is it exactly that's going to do that? And I would submit to you, and this is what I've been pushing, is you got to think local. You got to restore voluntary organizations. You need to solve your problems in-house. Don't run to the government for them. But her solutions are run to the government. She wants more of what is damaging those communal bonds.
The message of this American dream, the message that the world has sent us, told us, it's failing us. And our kids, especially young men, are feeling it the worst.
So there it is. The American dream is to blame. It's all the things you guys like are to blame. She's going to say barbecue's to blame next, and I'm going to lose it.
Each of you in this room is very, very unlikely to go out and commit an act of violence. But here's my challenge, and here's where I want us to reflect and be open to repentance. I think that we have unwittingly contributed to the milieu that breeds extremism and incites violence. There are the maybe outward ways, the way we treat our fellow human beings, particularly if we disagree with them, particularly if they're from a different political tribe. It's also
like what you're doing now.
So when we harbor contempt in our hearts towards others, that contempt finds its way out in our actions. But here's the thing that I think most of us are probably guilty of. It's our inaction. When we prioritize our own accomplishment, our success, our kids' success, our kids' accomplishments, over relationships, over deep community, over caring for those in need. Because doing all of those things takes a lot of time. It's our lack of active love for our neighbors. It's our lack of being invested in our local community. Now, I'm looking around this room, and I know that there are people that came from this local community. And I thank you for being invested in this community.
You guys all want your kids to do well in life. Shame on you. Shame on you. Got to stop investing yourself in your progeny and start investing in your community. What does that sound like to you? I just can't get away from the fact that this sounds like almost every 20th century totalitarian. Here's something. This is cool, right? Cool to think about. Jesus said, if you love family more than me, you're not worthy of me, right? And what's the interpretation of that? Was Jesus saying, don't love your family? No, because that would contradict so many other things in scripture. Jesus is saying that your love for him supersedes your love for those who you are most closely attached to. That's why there's a significant thing that Jesus, that's why it was powerful when Jesus said it. I'm the God who made you. I am. Allegiance to me is the fundamental, most important thing. Every totalitarian government, okay, and I don't care if you're talking about ones that are framed as right, the ones that are framed as left, whether you're national socialists, international socialists, totalitarian governments, 20th century totalitarian governments, now 21st century totalitarian governments. The thing that they want from you more than anything else, and now, and I would have to say liberal governments in the West. Just read The Demon in Democracy, right? We're by Legutko. It's the same thing. Arrived at, I think, through a different path. It's more gradual. But the thing they want from you is ultimate allegiance. It's veneration. It's basically worship, though they are not going to use that word because they believe in a separation of church and state and liberal democracies, at least. But they want you to elevate their principles of democracy and pluralism. And then in the case of other totalitarian governments that don't have that, whatever principle, whatever enchanting principle they have, the Volk, the will of the Volk, the party and what the party wants, like they want you to put that in the position that Jesus put himself. You must hate father and mother, turn them into the Stasi for the sake of loving the state, for the sake of loving this organizing principle that we knuckleheads with our abstract ideas that we thought up that don't even have good precedent half the time in any kind of traditional or experimental sense, but we figured out the key to organizing a society. You got to love those things and the people who give you those things beyond your family. I'm hearing echoes of that here with Elizabeth Newman, right? She would say she's probably arguing against the extremism that comes with totalitarianism and so forth. And to her credit, she did say get involved locally. But what she's saying, though, her solutions are we're not funding this on the national level enough. We need to spend less time on our children and more time in our communities with loving other people. And that means even attending the event that she's speaking at. This is our big problem, is we're just loving the proximate people to us. We're spending more time on our own betterment, on our children's betterment, on the things proximate to us. And we need to be more focused on the things that are a little more distant from us. And if we do that, then we'll avoid all this stuff. You need to love those things above what? Your children? I mean, you know, your children's success is what she's talking about. But what parent does not want their children to be successful and isn't willing to sacrifice everything so their children can be successful? I'm sorry if you know, and everything with the exception of what? The one organizing principle it's not even a principle, it's a person, Jesus Christ, right? That's what Christians understand, that Jesus takes preeminence. But every parent worth their salt has a natural instinct and frankly, as on the level of providing a God-given command to make their children successful on a certain level. You should be concerned with that stuff. And frankly, I'm more concerned about my kid's success than I am the success of my next door neighbor. And I'm not apologizing for it. And, you know, these people, Elizabeth Newman, these people that have these fancy ideas, they think that are going to just solve their problems, they end up making more problems. So your kid grows up and what? Dad didn't want my success. Dad was too busy with other people. Now, what is the kid going to be like? I don't know, maybe a target demographic group for violence. Ah, these people, I cannot stand. They're supposedly experts at our Christian institutions, and they're insane. They're absolutely insane with the, I'm not saying that she like should be committed, but I'm saying like what her ideas are fit for the laboratory, not fit for the, sorry. Her ideas are fit for the classroom, where not the lab.
I will tell you, I find it extremely hard in my professional career, and I think it's extremely hard for young people, college students about to enter the professional careers, to prioritize this over their professional success.
All right, we're going to end this thing. I want to play for you, though. This is the last sponsor, Mudhead Mom. If you don't like what you're hearing and you want your kids to have access to good resources, literature, then you're going to want to check them out.
About what your children are reading? Mudhen Mama understands how difficult it can be to find books that align with your family's values. That's why they carefully curated a collection of books for the whole family, from preschool to adults. Mudhead Mama offers an alternative to traditional book fairs, selecting books that celebrate truth, beauty, and goodness. With a wide range of genres, including classic literature, biographies, historical fiction, and more, their mission is to provide literature that fosters character and virtue in readers of all ages. Founded by Michelle Lazor, Mudhead Mama is committed to empowering parents guide their children's hearts and minds through thoughtful, faith-filled reading choices. For families looking to fill their shelves with MudHenMama.com today and discover the perfect book for every reader. Mud Hen Mama, where literature meets faith and values. Without the Darwinism, critical race theory, and liberal agenda. Use the code Harris to get 10% off your order. Go to MudHenMama.com today.
All right. A lot of us looking for Christmas gifts, and I don't know that it looked like a little jumpy in my connection there, but MudHenMama.com, MudHenMama.com. Enter promo code Harris. Let's finish this off with Wheaton.
If you want to change the world, that's how you do it. I'm not saying don't pursue your career goals or what God has called you to. But our lack of active love for our neighbors, that's what creates...
Okay, you Christians need to repent. You don't love your neighbors. Let's skip ahead to the end here. Okay, here we go. How does she end this?
To seek the welfare of the city where we have been sent into exile and to pray to the Lord on its behalf. This group probably knows this already, but it's worth reminding ourselves that that term welfare in Jeremiah 29:7, it's the Hebrew word shalom, which elsewhere is translated peace, but it's a deeper peace. It's a wholeness. It's an integrity.
Okay, so she ends this by just appealing to things that Christians find familiar that sound nice and will, I think, put a veneer over the insane things that she's said. Now, there is another speech that I have listened to, and it's a doozy. And there's also a panel at the end, which I haven't listened to all of it, but a little bit of it. So what I'm thinking is we've been going an hour and a half, a little over an hour and a half. We are not going to dive into that. I will save that, perhaps. I hope I don't. I mean, it depends on the news cycle. Maybe we'll lose it. But if we have time, I'll go over the next speech. And I'll just tell you a preview. Yes, it's about as bad, in my opinion. It's different, but it's pretty bad. This is what Wheaton's putting out there. I don't know if there's any pressure that can be applied except from the outside at this point. I wouldn't send your kid to Wheaton. That's just me. I think you got to be careful wherever you send your kids. I wouldn't send them to Wheaton if you're looking for a Christian school, to be quite frank, not just because of this, because of other things I know as well, but that's my opinion. Maybe you can go there and navigate it. But at this point, what are you funding? And there's better options out there for your kid. I mean, honestly, Liberty University would even be a better option than Wheaton to send your kid. So let's end this. Oh, someone said, insert, I ain't apologizing GIF. You know what? I haven't played it on the podcast, but maybe I should just play it. I know I released this video on the channel, so some of you already saw it, but I haven't played it on the podcast. And for those who don't know, yes, I recorded 10 songs in Tim Bushong's studio, and I'm going to release the rest of them. We're hoping for a January 1st date for the whole album, but I did release one song early just because it was before the election. And actually, William Wolf told me, you got to release it. Come on. He heard me play it. And he's like, you got to release that before the election. So if I can find it in my folder, we'll play the song I release now. It is appropriate for what we just listened to. And then I will just say, I hope you're having a great kickoff to the Christmas season. God bless.
A man told me on the internet, at least that's what I think he was, that my views were too offensive. He said I should lose my job, but he promised not to report me if I would do this one thing: give up my opinions and my faith and liberty. And this is what I told him. I ain't apologizing for what I didn't do wrong. The Bible on my dashboard, the flag out on my lawn, and you can bet I'll dig my boots in, 'cause my daddy didn't raise no son who'd disrespect his country or turn his tail and run. They say the country's filled with haters, and only they know how to love. Folks like me are trouble, 'cause we just don't go along. So they want to take our children and teach them how to hate the families they grew up in and how to love the state. Where could it be heading when doctors can't do their jobs? Monuments keep falling, police surrender to the mob. And parents can't trust teachers, and teachers can't trust kids. And kids can't tell their parents what bathroom they went in. I ain't apologizing for what I didn't do wrong. The Bible on my dashboard, the flag out on my lawn. And you can bet I'll dig my boots in, 'cause my daddy didn't raise no son who disrespect his country or turn his tail and run. Think if they could see us here, fighting wars a world away while our own borders disappear. Well, I bet they'd have opinions, and I bet they'd state their case, which would likely get them canceled in today's United States. I ain't apologizing for what I didn't do wrong. The Bible on my dashboard, the flag out on my lawn. And you can bet I'll dig my boots in, 'cause my daddy didn't raise no son who disrespect his country or turn his tail and run. I ain't apologizing for what I didn't do wrong. The Bible on my dashboard, the flag out on my lawn. And you can bet I'll dig my boots in, 'cause my daddy didn't raise no son who disrespect his country or turn his tail and run. And you can bet I'll dig my boots in, 'cause my daddy didn't raise no son who disrespect his country or turn his tail and run.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.
An O'Reilly Auto Parts gift card is the perfect gift for that hard-to-buy-for person. Give the gift of convenience from O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.